Good day. All sites are now on the conference line in a listen-only mode. I would now like to turn the program over to your moderator for today, Ms. Joyce E. Hurst. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, and welcome to our final conference call in our series on enhancing services in natural environments. As most of you know by now, these calls are sponsored by the OSEP Community of Practice on Settings, Part C Settings and Natural Environments, facilitated by the National Early Childhood TA Center and the Southeast Regional Resource Center. Our team includes Linda Pletcher, Tal Black, Sharon Ringwald, and myself at NECTAC, and Elizabeth Jackson and Delia Serpa at CERC. And then Linda, can I ask you to introduce Larry, please?
Yes, it's my privilege. We have Larry with us today. He is the senior instructor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Colorado Health Science Center. His background is in child development, organizational development, and instructional technology, and he has worked in the field of early childhood health and disabilities for more than 30 years. His degrees, both graduate and undergraduate, are in child development at the University of Pittsburgh. Currently, he's director of technical assistance and dissemination for the JFK Partners and is one of the primary instructors for the interdisciplinary training program. He is a consultant to the Colorado Department of Education and collaborates on early childhood initiatives regarding the provision of early intervention supports and services, early childhood assessment, service coordination, and the IFSP process. Larry has spoken in over 40 states and abroad. He's written, edited, and designed dozens of training and educational programs that have been adopted throughout the United States and internationally. Many of you have heard him in conferences or have used some of his training materials. And today, as he talks about change and the comparing the models for natural environments, I think he'll have lots to conclude our conference call session with. So, Larry, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Linda, and thank you, Joycey, and welcome to everyone on the call. I'm delighted to be a part of this series. I've been on all of the calls, and I've really enjoyed all of them. The format of this call, as you all know, is kind of quirky, not being able to exchange ideas together until the end of the call, but I'll do my best to just assume that you're out there. We're going to be moving quickly through some of the slides, and then we'll also dwell on some of the others, so I'll try to give you a heads up. Why don't we move to slide two? The Part C Settings Community of Practice articulated this as the purpose of this series of call, that is to better understand the various models of serving children in natural environments and also highlight some of the training and technical assistance available. Let's move on to the next slide, slide three. My assumption is that most of the listeners on the calls were not specifically wanting to hear the experts who presented, say, talk them into new practices, but rather hear what the different approaches are, and that most of the listeners on the call really want practitioners and programs to adopt some of these new approaches. I think we could all recognize that there's an abundance of research that supports the use of the recommended practices. The question for some of us might be, well, which practices? The practices from call two or the practices from call three, and are they the same or are they different, and in what ways are they similar and different? Let's move to slide four. To try to answer those questions, the focus of this call is going to be on the adoption process. Everett Rogers, who we'll be referencing throughout the call, defines adoption as the decision to make full use of an innovation as the best course of action available. Over the past few months, we've heard from seven leaders in the field about their approaches and models for providing supports and services. We're really going to look at those approaches through the lens of how might people adopt new things. That might tell us more about the innovations, and it also might tell us more about how we could promote and facilitate such practices. Let's move to slide five, which really is a reference to Everett Rogers' book, The Diffusion of Innovations. I highly recommend it. I've been using Rogers' framework to try to understand innovations in early childhood and other fields for a lot of years. His work was first published in 1962, and he's done a great job of updating it every decade since then, keeping pace very well with changes in technology and also other societal changes and patterns. What Rogers has done is he's reviewed thousands of research articles on social change and adopting new technology and innovation, and then he synthesizes those findings into a framework and generalizations that we could use to try to learn how to best promote things that are new. Why don't we move to slide 6? This quote by Demings, "All models are wrong, but some are useful," I think is true, and I'm applying that right now to Rogers' framework. I think that this frame of reference will really help us gain more insight into the models and practices that we've been discussing on the series of calls. But it's just a model, and in that it's not the truth, but I think it is a useful framework that will serve us during this call. Let's move to slide 7. Rogers defines diffusion in this way as the process by which an innovation is communicated through certain channels over time among the members of a social system. The fascinating thing is Rogers and other diffusion researchers have found that there are uniformities, there are regularities in the patterns of how people adopt new ideas, and that these regularities are found across cultures, across innovations, and across types of people who adopt things. The study of diffusion is really the study of social change, and as we all know, that's one of the most fundamental of our human processes. Let's move to the next slide, 8. If we took Rogers' definition of diffusion and broke it down into 4 elements, these are the elements that we're going to use to try to develop a deeper understanding of the recent innovations in early intervention supports and services, and how we've been doing and how we continue to do in the adoption of such practices. So what we'll do throughout the call for the remainder of our time is I'll review each of these 4 elements one at a time. So let's start on the next slide, which is 9. It's just a placeholder slide, with the first element in the diffusion process, which is innovation. And we'll move to slide 10. Rogers uses the words innovation and technology synonymously. He talks about innovation as being some kind of idea or a practice or perhaps even an object that's perceived as new by an individual or other unit of adoption. It could be a program, a community, a state, a nation. Technology, he defines as a design for instrumental action that reduces the uncertainty in the cause-effect relationships involved in achieving a desired outcome. Uncertainty is a very key theme in the diffusion literature, and the reason why is it's thought of to be an uncomfortable state that really motivates individuals to seek information. When we're presented with a new idea, we become uncertain whether or not it's better than the idea that it replaces, so we develop an uncertainty. That uncertainty makes us seek information to help us answer our questions, and information exchange is how social change occurs. And so it's that idea of uncertainty is very important. There's lots of examples of technology and innovation in our lives. We'll talk later about the diffusion of kindergarten from 1850 in Germany to worldwide dissemination in a very short period of time. Right now, I read an article this morning about the diffusion of hybrid automobiles, those that use electrical power and the internal combustion engine, and how that adoption is taking place. So it could be a set of ideas, it could be practices, but innovation and technology are really used synonymously. We'll move to slide 11. There's usually 2 components to innovations. There are software aspects, and there's hardware aspects. An example of a software aspect that was used during the calls is several of the speakers alluded to a knowledge base of the importance of gathering functional assessment information rather than other kinds of assessment information. They also mentioned during the calls a variety of pieces of hardware, and examples would be many interview guides, observational guides, inventory scales, etc. Tools were either mentioned or actually distributed during the call. So there's two components to innovations, both the software and the hardware. On slide 12 is an example of some of the hardware, some of the tools that were either referred to or distributed during the calls, and as you see, there's a number of them, and this is probably not a comprehensive list. As we see, just looking at the number of instruments and tools on this slide makes the practices that we're focusing on a bit complex, because I doubt that any of us would do our work by adopting and using all of these forms. So we're left with some questions. How does one instrument compare to another? Do we use one rather than another? Do we use them in tandem? Can we use them in slightly different ways than they were intended without losing their effectiveness? And so this is one example of the complexity that we'll talk about further in a little bit. Slide 13. The rate of adoption is the speed with which an innovation is adopted by the various members of a social system. The rate of adoption is usually measured by the length of time it takes for a certain percentage of the members of a social system to actually adopt an innovation. In the case of providing services in natural environments, I would guess that we really want to accelerate these kinds of practices, as we all know that IDEA has directed us to do so for at least 15 years and in the literature for at least 25 or 30 years. When we think about a social system, I invite you to think about your social systems. For some of you, you may think of your social system as a program. For others, you may think of it as a council. For some, an entire locality. In others, you may be thinking of a statewide adoption. And lastly, some of you may even be thinking about the nation at large. Let's move on to slide 14. This is a fascinating and, I think, very useful way of looking at innovations, and we're going to dwell on this for a while. What Rogers and other researchers have found is that there are certain characteristics of innovations that really explain how quickly a social system might adopt an innovation. Although there are lots of different characteristics, these five on this slide really are the ones that most explain how quickly a given social system will adopt an innovation. And as we apply this framework to the concept of services and supports in natural environments, I think you'll see what I mean. We won't review these definitions right now, but we'll do them one at a time. So if you turn to page 15, we'll look at one key element of these innovations that's very important to remember. The key word is perceived. It really doesn't matter so much what the objective characteristics are of an innovation. What matters is how the characteristics of something new are perceived by a potential adopter, by someone who is trying to decide whether to adopt or reject a new idea. So this is what's important. It's the receiver's perceptions of the attributes of the innovation that's important, not the attributes as described or classified by experts. And that's very important to remember as we proceed with this conversation. Let's look at slide 16. Why do we want to understand the characteristics of innovations? Well, it's because the research has found that there's a concept called positioning. And that views that at least some of an innovation's perceived characteristics are changeable. What that means is if you could find out how potential adopters of a practice are perceiving the innovation, you could change some of those characteristics in order to help make it more compatible. One example, during the series of calls, one of the presenters mentioned that they changed a particular word that is frequently used to describe a certain kind of intervention team because their experience was that negative word brought with it negative connotations in the minds of some potential adopters, and that the field has moved toward renaming it. As you recall, a couple of different conversations talked about the difference or similarities between the term transdisciplinary, and the term primary service provider. That's one example of how you could perhaps tweak, even if it's in a minor way, some of the characteristics of an innovation. Let's turn to 17 and let's start looking at what those five characteristics are. The first characteristic of an innovation that most explains the speed of its adoption is the relative advantage, which is the degree to which an innovation is, again, perceived as better than the idea it supersedes. The research shows that the higher the perceived relative advantage, the higher the rate of adoption. On slide 18, we're looking at a couple of questions that potential adopters might ask or wonder. Well, how is this new approach better than what I have been doing? After all, I know I've been having a good deal of success in my work, so why would I try something new? The thing that I'm working on right now seems to work just fine. A second question might be, well, wait a minute. Families prefer more clinical hands-on treatment approaches. They tell me that, so why would I use a different model than that? We need to learn how each of our potential adopters are thinking about the innovation so that we know how to establish dialogue and how to exchange communication that addresses potential adopters' questions about, is this better than what I've been doing? Let's move to slide 19 and look at the second element that describes the adoption. That's compatibility. This is the degree to which an innovation might be perceived as being consistent with the existing values, past experiences, and or maybe the needs of the potential adopters. And what the research again shows us here is the higher the perceived compatibility, the higher the rate of adoption. Let's look at page 20 and look at a couple examples of this. Potential adopters might ask a variety of questions depending on whether they were looking at the compatibility of the new innovation to their values. I've heard many times providers say, I'm not going to give up my discipline. Using a transdisciplinary approach means that I have to give short shrift to my discipline, and I don't want to do that. I value my training, my expertise, my experience, and the valuable technologies and frameworks of my discipline. Potential adopters might ask things about their past experiences. I've heard one practitioner wonder, well, the primary service provider approach may work for some, but it's not going to work with the kinds of kids and families who I've seen. It may not meet needs. I was in a meeting recently, and a provider expressed an exasperation that the approach of developing functional outcomes was not consonant with their need to write IFSP outcomes with families in ways that different funders demand in order to justify payment for services. So again, we see that we need to understand what the concerns are of adopters. If an innovation is not being perceived as being compatible with that which exists, people will resist it. They will not adopt it quickly, or in some cases of some innovations, they will not adopt it at all. Let's turn to slide 21 and sit back and relax, because we're going to be talking about this element of this characteristic of innovations a little bit longer than the previous two. Complexity is the degree to which an innovation is perceived as difficult to either use or understand. Unlike all the other characteristics of innovations, it's this characteristic in which the higher the perceived complexity, the lower the rate of adoption. Put another way, some innovations are readily comprehended by most of the members of a social system and will be quicker to be adopted. Other innovations are much more complicated, and the literature shows that the more complicated they are or are perceived to be, the more slowly they are adopted. So let's talk about this characteristic in a little bit more detail. On the next slide, slide 22, we see what different adopters might wonder. A trainer who's experiencing a perception of resistance might say, why don't they get it? A learner might wonder, wait a minute, what's the difference between this approach and that approach? Is it the same approach with different words, or do the words have different meanings? What Roger says is, in general, new ideas that are simpler to understand will be adopted more rapidly than those that are difficult to understand. I was in a meeting recently with a state administrator of a Part C program who in earnest asked the question, could someone explain what the difference there is between consultation and coaching? And this person wanted a very straightforward answer because they perceived a complexity in some of the models that people are talking about. Let's move to slide 23. Let's look at complexity more. These on this slide are some words that were used to describe some of the various models and approaches that were used during this conference call series. And this isn't all of them, but this is, we have a lot of different approaches, a lot of different models. I'm not even totally clear in my head which of the ideas we heard were advanced as a model with a more rigorous description of replication versus an approach that might be more something that could be incorporated into a variety of practices as strategies. But as we see here, the typical provider or administrator who's looking at these different words, these different approaches and models, how are we to know how they compare, how they are similar, and how they're different? Let's move on to slide 24. Let's keep talking about complexity. During the conference calls, these were different words that were used to label lists of ideas. Some of the presenters described characteristics of their model. Others described components of their model. Others offered touch points. Some offered constructs. Some used model and approach simultaneously. Some used one word or another. It does matter. We really need to clarify what these lists mean and how we're to put it into, how we're to put these ideas into practice. Let's look at slide 25, and again, we're not only looking at research and recommended practice, but we can't forget the enabling legislation behind most of our efforts. We can't forget the rules and regulations on a state and federal level, as well as program policy that increases the complexity. Slide 26 just articulates a conundrum that I don't want to go into in detail, but I think we need to acknowledge it. Different funding sources, different professional associations, and different researchers use somewhat different operational definitions for the term evidence-based. And as we are asked, and I think as a mark of professionalism, want to implement evidence-based practices, what criteria do we use for what practices we could consider to be evidence-based or research-based? And I think that's an issue that our field needs to grapple with in the short future. Slide 27, again, looks at artifacts of this complexity of service delivery models related to early intervention. These are words that were used during the series of conference calls. They're good words that when they are described in context, they make sense, but I'm not sure myself how they compare. Are some of these words different terms to describe the same phenomena, or do some of these words really bring with them radically different meaning? And if a typical practitioner is a listener in all of these seven calls or reads widely, how are we to think about this slew of terminology that certainly represents a lot of different ideas about services? This is, I think, best articulated, this frustration with complexity, on the next page. This was something that was said by a state agency Part C staff person and technical assistance provider, who said that, "I think we get so bogged down in what something's called and saying it the right way that it becomes more important than the content. How you say it or how you label it becomes more important than what you're doing or what you're actually talking about. trying to communicate in this kind of atmosphere is challenging because assumptions are made based on words that are used. This frustration, I think, is a very common perception right now that there's so much research and there's so much work being done in publishing approaches and recommended practices that we need to figure out how we're going to simplify the way we talk about things. The next slide, slide 29, is my take on what I heard in the conference calls, which are basically two very basic statements. The first is, there are some significant differences among the various approaches that have been presented in the series. Second statement is, there also seems to be some common themes. When I think of the common themes, I liken them to a concept that Everett Rogers writes about in his book, which is a technology cluster, which he describes as, it's a number of different distinguishable elements of a technology that are perceived as being closely related. And so I think when I try to think about the synthesis of what we've heard, it may be that we've heard about different elements that form a cluster of ideas that are at the root of the innovation. So let's look at them. Let's look at page 30, slide 30. These are the common themes that I heard as I took notes and listened to the various calls. It seems that most of the speakers in the series referred to each of these themes, although, and this is important to say, in some cases, the different presenters dealt with these different themes in different ways. It does seem that most of the presenters, if not all, somehow spoke to each one of these themes. Let's take a look at them, see what they are. On slide 31, there's this quote that everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. This is my disclaimer that the following little discussion we're going to have is my attempt to summarize some of the major similarities among the various approaches we've heard. I apologize in advance for either any misinterpretations I have or any of my shortcomings in explaining these themes in this type of call, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. So let's start with slide 32 and the first one. An individualized approach seems to be a common and universal theme among the different approaches we've heard. It's the assumption that supports and services will be tailored to meet the unique needs and characteristics of every child and family, and that cookie-cutter approaches don't work. One of the big shifts that relates to this individualized approach is many of the approaches that we heard on the series really highlighted the need for thoughtful gathering of information from families. Not just child assessment, but dialogue, listening to family stories, learning about families' routines, hearing about their accomplishments, their concerns, their interests, their assets, their priorities, their resources were words we heard. We heard that information gathering should be family guided. It should be centered on listening and being responsive. And we had several methods of tools, Robin McWilliams' EcoMap and routines-based interview that he had described are examples of those. Another part of the individualized approach is very thoughtful consideration for working with a wide diversity of families, with diversity expressed through culture, ethnicity, religion, socioeconomic status, or linguistic diversity. And there wasn't necessarily a lot of technology advanced in the calls, but there was articulation of thoughtful consideration. Let's look at the second commonality in the series, and that was of family-centeredness, of providing family-centered supports and services. The bullets on this page describe some of the descriptors of being family-centered that were discussed during the call. Being responsive to family-directed priorities, recognizing and supporting the family's role in all aspects of the early intervention and IFSP processes. We had speakers talk about building on the recognition that the family
is the primary influence on the child and has the greatest impact on young children's learning and development. And therefore, intervention needs to be offered in ways that honor that recognition. The pendulum seems to have swung that when we look at the purpose of early intervention, most of us have articulated that it's both to enhance and support a child's learning and development, but also to support the family's capacities in supporting their kids' learning and development. And that seems to be where a lot of these models are focused, on supporting families and parents' parenting roles. Let's move to the next common theme. One of the common themes was participation in families' everyday routines, activities, places, and relationships. Some of the elements of this that were articulated by most, if not all, the presenters were making sure that services and supports are delivered within context of families' lives, that they support participation as a key theme in everyday life, that outcomes and goals that we work on are functional rather than developmental. A key theme of all of the approaches is that the focus of services is to support that which happens between a practitioner's visits, rather than that the work of intervention happens during those visits. More than one speaker really talked about the importance of sharing information and perspective with families and helping families understand why our service approaches have such a great emphasis on providing supports and services within everyday routines, activities, places, and relationships. Let's move to the fourth common theme that I heard during the calls, and that is the concept of natural learning opportunities. Natural learning opportunities are basing our strategies on how all children learn, not children with particular developmental delays or disabilities, but just looking at how kids learn, what the influences are on children's development. It means having a sound understanding of typical infant toddler development. In a recent conversation I had with another administrator of a statewide Part C program, what she said was, our approach to early intervention needs to be much more consonant on how we support all children's learning, not just children who are Part C eligible. Focusing on naturally occurring learning opportunities rather than contrived and specialized instruction is another feature of this focus on natural learning opportunities. Let's look at the last of the common themes that I read into the conversations, which was the integration of supports and services, which was basing our supports, basing intervention on functional and integrated goals, avoiding a discipline-specific focus, a domain-specific focus, or in a uni-agency-specific focus. Rather, using team-based approaches, words that were often used were transdisciplinary and primary service provider, and focusing efforts collaboratively. If you look on slide 37, I tried to offer a framework here. The table on the slide is included in one of the handouts for this call, the handouts titled Strategies for Change Agents. What I propose in this table, that this table could be used as a worksheet in which you systematically identify how each of these four common themes are currently or could be infused into each step of the IFSP process. I personally think we should use the IFSP framework because we are all using it, that no matter what service model we seem to be using for Part C, the IFSP framework seems to be the sequence of service identification and delivery, planning and delivery and evaluation activities that we all use. So I just think this table might be useful to just see how these key practices we infuse in each step. I think that this could be a collaborative activity and should include all the stakeholders in your community, especially including parents as consumers of our services. I didn't include the first one, an individualized approach, because I think that that is an assumption that we all make and is embedded through the implementation of these other four common themes. Okay, on slide 38, it's a reminder to me and you to get back to the characteristics of innovations to remind us where we are. We just reviewed three of those characteristics. We reviewed relative advantage of an innovation. We reviewed the compatibility, and we just got done complexity that I warned you would be a lengthy discussion. Let's move to four on the next slide, slide 39, which is trialability. Trialability is the degree to which an innovation might be experimented with on a limited basis. The research shows that the higher the perceived trialability, the higher the rate of adoption. On slide 40, we think of a question that a potential adopter might wonder or ask, and I think one that I've heard over and over again is, well, can I try this out a little bit to see how it goes before I fully commit to it? And Everett Rogers would certainly agree with that, because what he feels, and from the research findings, is that an innovation that someone could try represents much less uncertainty to an individual, because they could learn by doing it rather than commit fully to it. One example that I'd like to mention that is here in my home state of Colorado, our lead agency, Early Childhood Connections, in the Colorado Department of Education, created last year something they called a provider incentive grant. We developed a call for proposals, and we funded a number of communities that wanted to have a small infusion of money to pilot new ways to either organize or deliver their services or supports. And in many cases, they were able to demonstrate great increases in their abilities to change the behavior of the service delivery system. So piloting could be a very, very powerful idea. Slide 41 talks about the last of the characteristics of innovations that are important to explain the rate of adoption. It's observability, that Rogers describes as the degree to which the results of an innovation are visible to others. And again, the higher the observability, or the perceived observability, the higher the rate of adoption. On slide 42, we see that there could be lots of questions, but one key question is, okay, can I actually see how the use of this approach in action has benefits, rather than just relying on research findings, just relying on what others are saying? Can I actually see it myself? Can I observe it? On page 6 of that handout that I referenced earlier, the strategies for change agents, is a grid called Characteristics of Innovations that lists these five characteristics of innovations that we just reviewed, and then has some blank space for you to try to ask yourself the question, how might we alter these characteristics in ways that will increase perceived relative advantage, increase compatibility, increase trialability, and increased observability, and I think most importantly with the innovation that we're talking about, and decrease the perceived complexity of it. So you may find that worksheet useful. That describes the innovation itself. We're going to move to the second element of diffusion, which is that it's communicated through certain channels. And we're going to begin that conversation on slide 44. Rogers describes communication as the process by which participants create and share information with one another in order to reach a mutual understanding. The essence of diffusion is this exchange in which one individual communicates an idea to another, the other reciprocates, and this exchange continues. On slide 45, it describes different literature in diffusion differentiates between two broad categories of communication. One is mass media channels, we transmit messages through some kind of mass media. It might be through video, books, DVD, or websites. But there's also interpersonal channels in which there's face-to-face exchanges between two people or more than two. This is important when we look at the next few slides. Starting on slide 46, what I did was I interviewed a number of practitioners who have been working on primary service provider teams that use many of the innovations and technologies that were described during the series of calls. In fact, many of the practitioners that I interviewed received training by many of the speakers and hold them all in extremely high regard. What I asked them was, how did you learn the skill and the knowledge that you need to succeed in your job delivering early intervention supports and services using contemporary models on a transdisciplinary or primary service provider team? Patty is a recent PT graduate. She just graduated a year ago in May of 2003. She knew from the very beginning from high school that she wanted to work as a pediatric physical therapist, and she did pre-PT training as an undergrad and then went right straight through without a break to her master's in physical therapy. The theme of what I learned from talking to Patty is her saying, I learned more in 3 weeks of being in families' homes than in all my years of schooling. Unfortunately, she was in a program that had almost no pediatric content. She talked about there were no classes on transdisciplinary approaches or on interdisciplinary communication, nothing on a private primary service provider approach. She received no training in consultation. She received very little, if any, detail about working with families, working on support issues. So I asked her how she did learn, and she said by doing it in homes, by getting a job in a program and shadowing and observing a veteran team member is how it all started. She had a very strong mentor. She also learned by using a framework. She said by applying her physical therapy framework, she realized that she really was not only doing the work of a physical therapist, but exceeding that in what she was able to deliver in terms of services to children and families. She attended workshops. She attended conferences. She talked about talking with many service providers. She talked about the value of talking with service coordinators. I think the message here in talking about Patty is that she didn't come into the field ready for this, but there was a variety of other learning opportunities that enabled her to start having success in her job. Let's look on slide 47 and look at a different story, Rachel, who my apologies, Rachel, if you're on this call, by referring to you as a veteran OT, an early childhood special educator. Rachel has been practicing for a little over 25 years, has an undergrad degree in OT and a master's in special ed. And what I think was very striking when Rachel described to me how she learned was, if you see on this timeline of her learning, it was on the job that she applied what she was learning. That she said, I did a lot of training. I had NDT training. I had SI training. But I didn't get it. I didn't learn it till I was on the job. She was a voracious learner and she was accepted for a fellowship at a university in early childhood and, again, had wonderful experiences, but it was the application with having a mentor that really helped her to learn. So as you see, there's many, many, many ways that Rachel learned. Let's look at the last case that I'd like to suggest to you. This is Casey, who's a current student, a current graduate student in early childhood special education, whose theme was, when I shadowed home visits, I realized how much I didn't know. I wonder if I got a job next week, how I'd be. What would I actually do? And this was interesting, and it was a kind of a light bulb that went off for me. This was the first person I talked to who said she learned by reading the literature. I've been very interested to find out recently from talking to different practitioners and program administrators in different states that practitioners are not reading to a large extent, reading literature, and when they're not reading the kinds of journals and books that are more cross-disciplinary. And I thought that evolution of her practice. She's just now graduating, and she's very much interested in getting the exact right kind of job, but knowing how hard it was just for her to find the right practica, that it was extremely challenging for her to find practica in early intervention, working on a transdisciplinary team. She knows that it's going to be very challenging for her to find just the right job. Slide 49 kind of summarizes some of the interviews I was doing with students, with new practitioners, with veteran practitioners. There's lots and lots of ways that practitioners learn the continual evolution of their practices. And I think that the point of this is that as trainers, as facilitators, as program managers, we need to offer a variety of very accessible learning opportunities, not just in-service, face-to-face, classroom-based instruction, but realize that people learn different ways. One thing I did want to highlight here is the literature shows that when about 20% of a given social system, and again, that could be your program, it could be your community, it could be your state, but when about 20% of your social system adopts a certain behavior, a certain practice, there is a very quick acceleration of adoption by others in the social system. And the reason for that is because social networking kicks off. And when I look on slide 49, talking to colleagues, talking to families, talking to service coordinators, we have to make sure we honor and recognize that lots of adoption happens because people are talking to peers or near peers, not just because they're reading research or attending conferences. Let's move on to slide 50. Over time, the third element of the diffusion process is that it occurs over time. Adoption doesn't happen at the same moment for everyone. If you look at the members of a social system, they adopt at different times. Slide 51 describes this phenomena and as the innovation decision process. This is a process through which each individual in a social system passes from first knowledge of an innovation to forming an attitude about it to finally a decision to adopt or reject it, to implement it if they adopt it, and to confirm that decision. Again, what Rogers research shows is that this process is a relatively regular, uniform process that occurs across situations. Slide 52 gives a overview of this process. It's the process in which we first get to know about an innovation's existence. Then we form an attitude that's either favorable or unfavorable. Then we engage in different kinds of communication exchanging activities that lead us to choose to either adopt or reject it. If we choose to adopt it, then we put it into use, and then we seek confirmation that it works for us. And this is a pretty regular pattern. Slide 53 offers one of Rogers' findings that individuals seek different kinds of information at different stages of the innovation process. This is key as we, as educators, trainers, change agents, facilitators of the adoption of new practices, try to figure out how we will communicate, when we'll communicate, what we'll communicate to try to promote this exchange. Slide 54 is a worksheet that's also in that Strategies for Change handout that I had previously referenced that you have downloaded from the website. On page 7 is this table. How you could use this is by trying to figure out at which stage of the innovation decision process potential adopters are in your social system, knowing that different adopters will be at different stages, and figuring what are the key questions that they have on their minds that they want to know. And then once you know what their key questions are, you could figure out what kinds of information you will give at that time, how you'll deliver it, who will deliver it, when it will be delivered. There's some interesting findings. One thing that Rogers' research indicates is that mass media channels, in other words, giving information through videotapes, through websites, through books, through DVDs, through CD-ROMs, through brochures, mass media channels are more important at the basic knowledge stage of helping people get a basic understanding of how something works. And the more interpersonal channels, the more face-to-face dialogues that we have, are much more effective at the persuasion stage when people are trying to figure out, well, what are the advantages for me? Will this work in my situation? Another piece of research I think that's interesting when we talk about how we're going to try to communicate about new innovations is mass media channels are more important than the interpersonal channels for the earlier adopters. And this is very important. What that means is an earlier adopter, someone who has the kind of characteristics that's likely to innovate early in a diffusion process, someone who adopts earlier is more likely to be influenced by some of the mass media. That's important. That means that a compelling research article may be persuasive for someone who is quick to jump on board, but may not be for some of the later adopters. So anyway, I think this grid could be useful in strategizing how to communicate about the new approaches to early intervention supports and services that have been talked about during the call. Slide 55. I hope you're still with me out there, because we're going to have an exchange pretty soon about a lot of these ideas. Reinvention. This is something I think we have to pause and talk about. Reinvention is the degree to which an innovation is changed or modified by a user in the process of adopting it and implementing it. For researchers, the opposite of reinvention is fidelity, right? Is that you implement a practice or a sequence of activities as precisely as you can the way that the model was described. Well, so the question that we have is not just going to be simply, will they adopt it? But the question is more complex. The question really is, well, if they adopt it, how will they change it in ways that's going to give meaning to them as they apply it to local context? This is so important. I think this is an enormous issue. When a researcher refers to a model as a standardized approach, how much can we change it? And what ways can we change it without risking that the changes will strip the innovation of what the expected desirable consequences are? Put another way, you know, to what extent can we reinvent certain early intervention practices without risking their presumed effectiveness? Well, one of the reasons this is important is because national studies have shown that people in education, people who adopt educational type innovations, more than half of the adopters only implement selected aspects of the innovation. They're eclectic. In other words, people in our field are relatively eclectic in how we adopt. The other thing to remember is reinvention is not always a bad idea. Sometimes reinvention is necessary to help fit an innovation to our local conditions. You know, one example that we talked about earlier about kindergartens. You know, when kindergartens spread from Germany, the diffusion began in about 1850, and in a very short period of time, there were kindergartens all over the world. However, each country that adopted kindergartens reinvented it so that it was consonant and fit the values and other elements of that culture. So reinvention is not necessarily a bad thing. However, we have to be very cautious in wondering to what extent we could reinvent certain models and approaches without sacrificing their presumed effectiveness. Let's move on to slide 56. You'll be delighted to know that this is the last element of the diffusion process that we're going to review. The social system forms the context for social change and the adoption of an innovation. Slide 57 lists some of the elements in a state that may influence the state's decision about whether they will adopt or reject a certain practice, whether or even which certain practice they may adopt or reject. And we're not going to go into a great detail here, but I think if you look at this list, you could probably come up with many, many examples of how, you know, this rich contextual landscape for states, communities, and programs are going to influence adoption decisions. If you just look at the state's economy, if you look at the political climate, if you look at the current infrastructure, if you look at licensure and certification requirements, if you look at the population base throughout this, we could see that it's very complex, that we can't adopt new practices independent of the systemic context. 58th slide talks about why we need to look at this with great care, because as we know, there's significant variations in these kinds of system elements that we just looked in the previous slide, between states, between counties, between cities, between agencies, and even between programs within the same agency. As we know, many programs are centralized, while others have a more home rule type ethic. So let's summarize. Let's look at slide 59, see where we're at. What to do? What do we do with this? What do we do with looking at this incredibly rich resource of models and approaches that we've heard during this series in calculating the complexity of it and figuring out which parts of it fit the local constraints? I think one of the first things is we need to avoid thinking, as a Part C person in an eastern state told me recently. I won't tell you what state, but it was one of the 13 original colonies, who told me recently is we need to avoid thinking that these kinds of changes need to happen over 7 years. And I absolutely agree. The new conceptualizations of early childhood that have been described in this series, I don't think are revolutionary changes. I think they're more evolutionary changes, and that they are now extending what we know about children, what we know about families, what we know about development, learning, what we know about family support, and how we regard how we could best be supportive of children and families. I think we've been working on these changes incrementally over years. Granted, I think there's essential systemic changes that may take years, but there's other things that can change just as soon as adopters decide, yes, this is right, and I'm going to do it differently. On slide 60, I propose a few ideas to consider, and I just want to review these briefly before we open it to questions. So, Joycey and Linda, if you're chomping at the bit for me to stop, I will very shortly.
Larry, I think you're just doing fine.
Thanks, George. The first idea to consider is that in light of the complexity and the variety of approaches at hand, please be sure to clarify your own understanding of the innovations that you will promote. I think an example I give to the very thoughtful administrator who asked the question, what are the differences between coaching and consultation? You need to know how to thoughtfully and articulate, know what the differences are and which approach you seem to be talking about adoption for your particular social system. So I think that the most important thing is, one thing I've heard Robin McWilliam talk about is he says, oh, please be careful about shopping around and by having one approach, and let's give people this approach, and then let's give them this one, let's give them that one, to the point where there's a lot of complexity and a lot of confusion over where does one model and approach begin and where does one end, where are they similar and where are they different. The second is related, is we need to be very thoughtful, maybe even cautious, about when we adopt, how much will we adapt and how much will we reinvent. And in piecing together and being eclectic, and by the way, I am all for eclecticism, but we have to be extremely thoughtful in making sure that in our eclecticism, we're not neglecting certain elements of a model or approach that are essential to its presumed effectiveness. I think we need to think systemically when adopting and promoting new service models. I think in this way, there are elements of the Part C system that absolutely need to be refined and modified in order to support the adoption of certain innovations in early childhood supports and services. It's not just a matter of let's, quote, train them, unquote. We need to think systemically. We have to make sure that we identify which elements of the system need reform. The fourth bullet is, we need to infuse these practices in all steps of the early intervention and IFSB processes. We have to really take to heart what we heard all the presenters talk about during this series. These models, these approaches, and the common themes that we reviewed during this call need to be infused in all steps of the support process, from referral through to transition out of Part C into other supports and services. It's not just about the phase of service delivery. Articulate clear guidance to the field. I am very impressed watching many states develop guidance materials, develop policy, develop training that is clearly articulating guidance rather than a more casual approach to, oh, there's a lot of new literature out, folks, go get it. The next bullet is, I think we all would need to remember that training is essential but not sufficient. The kinds of changes we want to see in our services supports will not happen without training, but I think we have to realize that it's not sufficient, that there needs to be more systemic solutions as well. The third to the last bullet is, we need to offer practitioners a variety of accessible learning opportunities beyond classroom-based training. I think that networking, mentoring relationships, coaching, making field trips, spending time with other programs, there are a huge number of ways that practitioners tell us that they really learn and really get new approaches, and we need to honor that by making that available and accessible. I think that we should consider implementing pilot projects. I think that incremental change is often easier for folks, and I think they're often more likely to try something new when they could be piloting a new idea, collecting data, refining as they go, and making their adoption decisions based on that information. And lastly, part of the series of this conference calls was to talk about what training and technical assistance is available, and I was delighted to see how much training and technical assistance resources were available through journal articles, through the experts who presented on the series' willingness to do training and technical assistance, for websites and all these other resources. However, we need to remember that there are tens of thousands of practitioners, of service coordinators, of programs, of states, who really do need high-touch, interpersonal, face-to-face contact, and there aren't enough nationally regarded model makers and experts to go around. States really need to build their own capacity to provide this kind of high-touch communication exchange, in addition to relying on the expertise of others who travel nationally. Slide 61 lists the references for this call, which are really Everett Rogers' book that I highly recommend, who people who found some of the ideas that I discussed today interesting. And I also used extensively the handouts and the PowerPoint slides from the presenters in the call. I did want to alert you to a couple of resources that you might want to know about from the state of Colorado that are on the last slide, slide 62. One is the videotape Just Being Kids, which I know some of you may have seen. It's a videotape that was developed by a collaboration between the Part C Lead Agency in Colorado from the Colorado Department of Education, as well as Project Enrich, which is a project where I work at JFK Partners at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center. This videotape has a very good track record in helping providers to see some of this stuff in action and hear some of the providers and families talk about its meaning. And it's available for a pretty reasonable cost. So I would recommend that. The Enrich Outreach Project that was funded several years ago by OSEP developed this project and lots of other training materials. We still do a little bit of training, but as that grant ended, it doesn't encumber our time like it used to, and so the training that the Enrich Outreach team has offered in the past can only be minimally offered. But I did want to alert you to two resources. One is Resources and Connections is a very brief newsletter that comes out four times a year, and we publish this for Colorado practitioners, service coordinators, families, and it has just different themes each issue related to innovative practices. We did some research and found out that practitioners do not have time to read a lot of journal articles, so we pick key journal articles and write one-page abstracts of them. We write some key articles, and at this website listed on your handout, you could go review and download all of the back issues. The other thing is the Early Childhood Connections website, which is Colorado's lead agency, develops a whole lot of different resources, and so I encourage you to go browse around there, too. Now, I just wanted to make sure you knew about those resources. And with that, I thank you for your kind attention, and I'll turn it over to Linda and Joycey.
Thanks, Larry. We're about to have our question and answer period. That was an excellent presentation. Genevieve, are you available?
I am. I'm right here. If you have a question at this time, please press the star and the one on your touch-tone phone. To withdraw that question, press the pound key. Again, if you do have a question at this time, please press the star and the one on your touch-tone phone. And when I do say your name and your location, please respond by first stating your title before you ask your question. We'll go first to Diana Otten from Newark, New Jersey. Please go ahead.
Hi. I'm the co-director of the Statewide Parent Advocacy Network, and I am also the co-director of the Technical Assistance Center that provides technical assistance to all of the federally funded parent centers for infants, toddlers, children, and youth with disabilities in Region 1, the Northeast. And I'm a parent. First of all, I've been able to participate in about two-thirds or three-fourths of the calls, and I found them all to be incredible. And I found this call to be very useful in helping to consolidate some of the information from all of the very outstanding calls. I think first a comment and then a question. I think the comment you mentioned that something about social systems and how change happens in social systems. And I think one of the problems is that you're really talking about a multitude of systems, of social systems, when you're talking about early intervention, because you're talking about the governmental entity and the social systems that it's part of, the provider entities, which, you know, in many states such as New Jersey are not part of the government but contract with the government, and then you're talking about, and they have their own social systems, and then you're talking about families, which, you know, which actually represent a multiplicity of social systems. And so while there may, I think the process of change among these different, you know, partners in early intervention really is more complicated than other kinds of change may be, like in, say, for example, in a corporation where, you know, you have a lot tighter hold on participation, et cetera. And one of the questions that I've been consistently asking every presenter is, well, there are two questions, really. One is the issue of you know, kind of the role of families and how can we reach families before they are told by people outside the early intervention social system that what they need is, you know, 10,000 hours of blank, you know, for their child, and that doesn't understand early intervention or the focus on enhancing the family's capacity or any of those things. And then the second part of that question is, how can... I think it's very difficult for the early intervention agency to manage change the way that your very useful and informative slides talk about managing change, especially when they're contracting with external agencies to provide services. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about either of those things. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. I have lots of thoughts about them. I'm sure a lot of other callers do too. Let me just give you a couple of things that was going through my mind. Everywhere I travel, and I travel pretty extensively, I hear people asking the same question you do, is how will we help families to adopt a particular vision for what the intent, purpose, and method of operation is of early intervention, when for a long time we've probably taught families that it means very intensive clinical hands-on direct service and that change occurs while a practitioner is laying hands on a child. A couple of things happened that I could tell you in Colorado. One is through videotaping practitioners and families, we found that a large majority of service coordinators and practitioners were not really able to communicate that verbally. The other thing that if we all in our respective states looked at the kind of public awareness materials that we distribute to families, do those materials accurately and directly tell families what this rather new conceptualization of supports and services in early intervention mean? What we're doing in Colorado is we've been talking for a while about developing what we call a scripting initiative, where we're getting stakeholders together to literally put down the kinds of thoughts and words and messages that we want families to receive that will help them to develop a perspective on early intervention very, very early. We're looking at that in terms of both guidance material for practitioners and service coordinators, as well as materials directly given to families. Right now, we're doing some focus groups with family members and service coordinators, asking them what would be in these materials that would be useful. So I think how I answer your question is, you're right, that's a problem. We need to be much more systematic and systemic in developing communication strategies where we're going to get the right information to families, both in terms of what they're told and what they may read on websites and brochures and such. But your other question about managing change, it is daunting. You know, the kinds of decisions we talked about during this call were basically the kinds of decisions that individual adopters make. But in Roger's book, he has a whole section of his model that's more geared towards how systems make adoption changes. And one of the things that I came to mind when I listened to your question was, I know of a couple of examples of states that very clearly made statements to the field and gave guidance. And I'll give you an example of Colorado, where an administrator from our lead agency in a statewide video teleconference plain out just came out and said, we have a very specific
expectation for how we will be delivering services, and described a transdisciplinary primary service provider model. And I certainly perceive, as others, as that very direct articulation was a catalyst that helped to provoke change in our state. We still have a long way to go, but I think that was a very important event.
Once again, to register for a question, press the star and the 1 on your touch-tone telephone. To withdraw that question, press the pound key. Again, if you do have a question at this time, please press the star and the 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Okay, it appears that we have no further questions at this time. Okay, we've just had 2 register. Our next person comes from Harry Friedman from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Please respond with your title before saying your question.
Thank you. This is actually Mary Zaremba. I'm part of the Early Childhood Network at the Center for Development and Disability, and we're responsible for training and technical assistance here in New Mexico to early intervention programs. And my question is, because I'm so impressed with Patty and Rachel as 2 examples who seem to have the ability to reflect on their experience and what they'd like to do with themselves professionally, how, Larry, would you address the area of motivation? I appreciate the innovation decision process that you described, and how is it that we can get people to even ask the questions going beyond where we might be present with them in a training situation where we have to determine, or prior to when preparing for a training, well, where are these folks at with this particular issue or question or area of a service delivery, NEI services? So how do we address that personal, professional motivation of each individual?
And Mary, you're going to let me know when you solve that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm struck by I have a colleague, Ann Grady, who is a longstanding occupational therapist, writer, trainer. And what Ann has always done when she communicates with providers is, in a very friendly way, she reminds them of a couple of hallmarks of professionalism. And she does this in a very engaging way, and I've seen her do this in both writing and as she speaks with people. And what Ann has always reminded practitioners is that there are several hallmarks of professionalism that move beyond technical aspects of one's discipline. And those 2 hallmarks of this: one is, by accepting certification, licensure, you're accepting the responsibility for the continual advancement of your own practice and for the advancement of one's field. And it's an ethic, realizing that if I were only to deliver static services, then I would be delivering services out of touch with research, out of touch with contemporary changes in family life, changes in communities and cultures. And so it would be tantamount to malpractice to be not continually advancing one's individual practice, plus, through whatever efforts, trying to advance the practice of one's field in general. That's one of the elements of professionalism that I always try to, under Anne's inspiration, remind folks. The second part of it is to remind folks that they are lifelong learners, and that the days are over. The days are long over when any of us goes to school and learns something and then applies that the rest of their life. That the only way we could keep up with the changes in technology in our lives is to consider ourselves lifelong learners and accept that responsibility. So I have had very good luck trying to articulate those 2 principles to folks.
That's great. Thank you. And I also wanted to comment that we use and enjoy and find successful just being kids as a vehicle to convey some of the information that you've been talking about. Thank you for developing it.
Oh, thank you. And I'll take that as a thank you to me, the Colorado Department of Education, and Project Enrich, who were all collaborators in that.
We're out of time for today's call, and I really want to thank Larry for his excellent wrap-up and for all of you who have participated in today's call and many of you in the whole series of calls.